Well, that was a more extensive blood libel on American conservative nationalists than I had expected to encounter. And I'm not quite prepared to go as hammer and tongs as that lead-in might suggest. I will say that in terms of nationalism, there's a need to defend the nation-state as a political entity. If you are going to have self-government, you have to have a polis. If you're going to have a polis, the question is on what scale? Is it going to be a city-state? Is it going to be something else? Or is it going to be a nation-state? In the case of the United States, we have a federal system, which in fact balances a high degree of local government with a national government as well. Both of those elements feed into the American federal system, and you can't really have one without the other. So it's very important for conservatives to defend their states and to defend their localities, but the nation state as a whole surrounding it is important for foreign policy, for the economic defense of the various regions, and for harmonizing the interests between these different elements within our country. When you get away from that, you have a breakdown that can lead, of course, to civil war, as we've seen, and you can have sort of weakness and manipulation by foreign powers, which is one of the things that drove us to create the Constitution in the first place. So the idea that American nationalism would be closely related to ethno-nationalism or something like that seems rather dubious. I should mention as well, the very term ethno-nationalism contains in itself a redundancy that should raise the suspicion of people who are thinking for themselves. Ethne, of course, is the Greek term for nation. Nationalism and ethno-nationalism refers, as Dylan had said, to natio, which is the Latin word for a nation. The fact that you have this redundancy indicates that there is a form of nationalism, that in fact nationalism, as the term had broadly been used, was not sufficiently ethnic to indicate that it was a purely sort of blood and soil conception. So ethno-nationalism as a term, it's redundant and it exists because nationalism by itself is not necessarily going to be as ethnically based as the more horrifically sort of blood-oriented people would like it to be. Now, I'm going to start my remarks proper with a couple of prefatory points, both of which are in fact drawn from the Wall Street Journal. Just yesterday, reporters Aaron Zittner and Alex Leary wrote the following. Working class white voters make up 59% of the party, this is referring to the Republican Party, up from 50% in 2010, while working class voters of all races account for more than two-thirds of all GOP voters. This is according to Wall Street Journal, NBC News polling over the years. The reporters continue, in tandem with this change, the Republican Party now represents more middle and lower income Americans than it did a decade ago. When all the U.S. House districts are ranked by median income, the GOP represents 58% of the lower income half of the spectrum, up from 39% of the lower income districts a decade ago. And it represents 34% of the higher income half, down from 43% a decade ago. So you can see that there is a change afoot in American politics, especially on the right as it's represented by the Republican Party. The second prefatory remark I want to mention bounces off of one of the remarks we heard from Bill McGurn yesterday. McGurn, as indeed Dylan did as well, talks about trade as if it's taking place in a vacuum and that it's simply a matter of honest buying and selling, and that therefore any restriction upon what one buys is an infringement on liberty. But consider a case where, for example, the mafia decides it's going to knock a store, a warehouse, or a truck transporting goods. It steals those goods and starts selling them. This is not obviously a free market operation. This, even though the buyer may still be acting in good faith, the seller is not. So the idea that simply buying and selling is a neutral action really depends upon the context in which it's taking place and the honesty in which the production or the acquisition of goods originally occurred. This, I think, applies very strongly to the case of China vis-a-vis the United States. China is not a free market entity. It is a communist-controlled entity which uses free market mechanisms for its own advantage. And it is quite willing to violate the free market whenever it thinks it can do so in order to capture greater market share. So we've seen in the past currency manipulation on the part of China. We've seen, of course, their support for state-owned industries. They have a state-dominated banking sector, which is also very careful to support their industry. they have a number of regulations which insist that if a foreign company wants to come in and sell within the Chinese market, it has to have a domestic partner. And through these domestic partnerships with Chinese firms, the Chinese government and the Chinese business community siphon away intellectual property and generally learn to manipulate their Western partners. The Western partners, because they subscribe to the liberalism that we've heard recommended by a number of our speakers at this conference, generally have a servile and even perhaps suicidal attitude towards the Chinese Communist Party. So we've seen this on the part of the National Basketball Association quite recently. We've seen this, of course, from Michael Bloomberg, one of the outstanding liberals who has run New York City in the recent past. Bloomberg has told Firing Line, the revived version of it with Margaret Hoover as host. He said that Xi Jinping is not a dictator. He has to appease his constituencies. Well, this is a very, very idealistic view, to say the least, of what's actually happening in the Chinese political system. So let's now look at what conservative economic policy is and how it relates to a very dynamic world in which, over the past 200 years, we've seen vast changes not only in the economic order, but in the social order as well. We might begin our investigation by looking back at one of the sort of defining conflicts of the early 19th century, namely the fight over the Corn Laws. Now, as most of you will know, these Corn Laws were agricultural protections. They kept the price of corn, of grain, inflated in the United Kingdom. And these laws were actually opposed by the leader of the Conservative Party at the time. The Conservative Party was newborn, and the Corn Laws were something that Robert Peel, its leader, tried very vigorously to abolish. The Corn Laws existed because earlier, during the French Revolutionary Wars and the Napoleonic Wars, the following set of circumstances had come together. First of all, the price of grain was very high because trade had been interrupted by the war. Second, in order to finance the war at a time when grain prices were very high and the state of agriculture was quite parlous, there was an emergency income tax created. And this was a change from the previous tax order to which the British were accustomed. In peacetime, generally the agricultural producers bore the burden of taxation. So after the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, there was a sudden change in these conditions. Now foreign grain could be purchased again, the price of grain fell, and the tax burden shifted back to the agricultural interests as well. The wartime measure of the income tax was going to be replaced by, once again, more taxes on agricultural production. So this was something of a double or even a triple whammy upon British agriculture. And the Corn Laws were the price they extracted for going along with it. Basically, the squirearchy, as it's called, the small agricultural lords, were able to press for having protections to keep up the corn prices so that they weren't at the same time being hit by lower prices for their products and also a higher tax burden as a result of the shift back to the pre-war economic dispensation. So it's understandable why the squirearchy would want to have these protections, why it would want to have the Corn Laws. It was not a sadistic attempt to inflate the price of bread during the early stages of the Industrial Revolution. It was selfish, yes, but it was also selfish in a way that tried to preserve their own standing in a world that had been shifted around by war and by a number of policy changes brought about by war, which had put the agricultural interests in a very difficult position. Well, Robert Peel saw that this was nonetheless very problematic and that these Corn Laws were making the plight of the British working class quite bad. And so he was working very hard in order to abolish the Corn Laws. So here you have a Conservative Party early in the 19th century, which is adopting basically freer trade and is trying to get rid of protections upon an industry that was actually very basic and very essential to the Conservative Party's own base of support. That the squirearchy was in fact sort of the old and surviving remnant of what had been the Tory Party in earlier centuries. By the way, the Tories and the Whigs actually went back and forth in the 17th century and 18th century as to which one was protectionist and which one was for freer trade. But in any case, by the early 19th century, you actually had the early Conservative Party being quite favorable towards freer trade. However, this was extremely controversial within the Conservative Party, and it basically leads to the fracturing of the Conservative Party under Robert Peel, where you have the more free trade-oriented, more philosophically liberal side of the British Conservative Party in the early part of the 19th century, splintering off and eventually forming a coalition with the Whigs and becoming the new British Liberal Party. Sir William Everett Gladstone, for example, who is the outstanding liberal prime minister of the 19th century, he, for example, had started out as a Peelite conservative. The conservatives then in the 19th century Britain try to adapt to a new environment in which the Industrial Revolution is taking place. You have the rise of an industrial proletariat. You have demands for an increasing widening of the franchise. And you have demands eventually in the latter half of the century on the part of workers for greater protections, you know, in terms of protections for their jobs, but also protections for their health and well-being. And the Conservatives try to play a, under, for example, Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli, they try to play a very dynamic game here. They try to, what they call, what Disraeli calls, dish the Whigs, to basically circumvent and get around them and appeal beyond the Whigs to some of the rising working class and lower middle class elements in British society. And Disraeli, of course, winds up supporting a reform bill, and he winds up getting, to some extent, a degree of support from the working and especially the middle classes that conservatives at the outset of the 19th century had found rather difficult to gain. Nevertheless, it's actually not these developments which wind up leading to the downfall of the Liberal Party in the early 20th century, but rather the rise of the Labour Party instead, the Labour Party being very much directed in the early part of the 20th century toward labor interests, towards working men's interests, towards the interests of the new industrial workforce. So you have a complex interaction here between political classes, between rising economic interests and falling economic interests, and political parties. And the liberals wind up being, you know, having a rather harder time navigating this than the conservatives do under a creative genius such as Benjamin Disraeli. The rise of the Labour Party eventually creates basically a polarization in British politics over the question of the power and status of labour, which winds up creating a division between labour and the conservatives and leaving the liberals somewhat in the middle and somewhat at a disadvantage. Well, in America, we see somewhat similar and parallel developments. When you see the rise of an industrial workforce here in the United States, great questions arise and start to divide the political parties, both divide them and also sort of bring them together, because there's a need for both parties, both the Democrats and the Republicans, in the early and middle part of the 20th century, to address the fact that you now have this rising employee workforce, this rising workforce that is often working in large industries. During the late 19th century, the workforce was quite radical and was indeed given towards sort of socialistic uprisings, towards strikes. There was a great deal of violence in American labor and industry. And in the early 20th century, both the Democrats and the Republicans wanted to see this brought to an end. I should say a few words about sort of a change that took place in the nature of America's labor force in the 19th century. Obviously, of course, you have the frontier. You have people like Frederick Jackson Turner writing about the significance of the frontier. But America's workforce was highly mobile and free. If you didn't like your lot in life, whether you were in a place like perhaps Manchester, England, or whether you were perhaps in Boston, Massachusetts, wherever you might be, if you wanted to simply pull up stakes and move to the American frontier, or even move not quite to the frontier, but simply to the booming and growing population within the middle of the American continent, you could do so. And of course, you could do this and get very affordable land. You could do this as a perhaps prospector for mineral wealth. But you could also do this as simply a small businessman going out there and starting a new service firm of your own, perhaps becoming a barber, for example, in some frontier town. So this meant that the American labor force in the early and middle part of the 19th century was quite mobile, it was very entrepreneurial, it was highly free. It did not feel as if it was being controlled by any kind of, sort of master over its shoulders. It had some difficulties with American finance. The 19th century is characterized by a number of battles over banking and credit, debt, and how to liquidate debts that become too burdensome. This, of course, is one of the great causes of the populist movement, the original populist movement in the late 19th century. But in general, you have a workforce, a sort of American rising middle class that you see supporting Jackson and then later on supporting the American Whig Party that is highly free, highly independent, and relatively strong in the sense that at least it can fend for itself. It is not sort of prey to too many powerful national forces or transnational forces other than the credit and banking system. By the 20th century, however, you find that the workforce has become an employee workforce, and employees, while they're free to move from employer to employer, nevertheless, the overall status of an employee is less free, perhaps, than that of someone who has the frontier and cheap land and all the opportunities that had been on offer in the 19th century. So this American workforce, while it is in some respects less free, nevertheless, it has a great deal of political power, partly because it is a concentrated workforce, geographically speaking. And it has economic, sort of professional interests that are in specific places. This allows not only for the creation of labor unions, but it also means that even without labor unions, you have interests which are sufficiently localized that they're able to express their power in elections, district by district. And so this workforce, much like the rising industrial workforce in the United Kingdom, is in a position to demand certain things from government, to demand various workplace protections, to demand various protections of their jobs. And you see a sort of contract emerge, a social contract, in which government and business and the employee workforce come to an agreement in order to forestall strikes, in order to forestall industrial unrest, in order to keep everyone as satisfied as possible. And this is where you get the institution of large employers providing for most of the social needs of their employees, whether that's in the form of pension plans, or as of course is now a great concern for us, the health insurance that employers may be providing to employees. So the federal government is providing certain supports for the employee workforce. Businesses themselves are providing others, and generally business and government and labor are all coming together in a sort of mixed economy. Well, this breaks down in the 1970s when we get a great many failures on the part of Keynesianism pursued by government. We get the idea that freeing up the economy will be a great boon to American business, that creating new firms will be create a new wave of prosperity that will not require the kind of managed economy that we saw emerge in the mid-20th century. And so you have these golden years, the 1980s and the 1990s, when you have a boom in technological prosperity, a freeing up of the market, and in general a sense that America does not need these older mid-20th century institutions by which large employers were providing for their workers and the welfare state was backstopping the large employers. And that seems to work quite fine until, of course, you have ongoing dislocations of industry as a result of global competition, and in particular, competition from China. At the same time, you see that American finance and some of the new technological companies that are dependent upon high finance start to work out a new kind of deal of their own with government. And this is very much what you see in evidence in 2007 with the Great Recession and the fact that government comes to the rescue of the financial institutions after seeing a couple of them fall and create great shockwaves in the economy. It's what you see with a company like Amazon, which is able to go for a decade or more without turning a profit. Well, finally, they're able to become profitable, and this reaps great rewards for their financial investors. The result of the changes that you see in the American economy in the latter half, actually the latter, sort of 10 years of the 20th century and into the first 20 years now of the 21st century, is the development of an economy that has more or less three tiers. And these tiers are very difficult to name, but I'll characterize them at least broadly here. The first being the financial tier. These are the greatest economic winners. They're the ones who are, you know, the cause of the inequality that is so lamented by the American left. But the financial tier includes people who perhaps can live off their investments, people who are able to deploy their investments and their financial resources for new technological innovations, as we see with the tech companies. So the technological tier and the financial tier are very closely aligned with one another. And in a general way, they will claim to be in favor of free markets and of innovation. However, they do want these ultimate protections from government, especially of the financial system. And they also are quite willing to use their economic power to change America's social character. And we see this with the rise of woke capitalism. That basically there almost seems to be a sense in which corporate America wants to purchase indulgences from the new priesthood of political correctness, that they want to take the great wealth they have and they will support the hard left in order to sort of wash their hands of the guilt of being successful in at least a quasi-market competitive environment. Well, the second tier of the new American economy is what I would refer to as the administrative tier. And it's not necessarily that everyone in this tier is an administrator, but rather they work in fields where administration is overwhelmingly powerful. So some of the largest fields of growing employment in the United States include various health services. They include education. These are areas which, while not, well, sometimes, you know, partly government-controlled and partly sort of semi-private, nevertheless have an enormous scope for government regulation, and we see the manifestation of that in the sort of parasitical growth of administrative power within both of these fields. So both in education and in healthcare, the amount of administrators in these fields has just blossomed like a weed. This is especially true in education. I mean, people look at the cost of higher education. They think that this is perhaps driven by maybe the salaries of professors. Well, it isn't. It's driven by the growth of the number of administrative offices. And often these administrative offices are concerned about, again, enforcing a kind of politically correct dogma upon the students and the pupils within their charge. Finally, the third tier of this new developing American economy is a service tier that is rather different from past tiers of service economies, because it is surprisingly not very mobile. It doesn't move around very much. It's very free in one sense, in that it is not strongly attached to any kind of institution, to any employer, for example, or to any other set of kind of civil society institutions. It's a very sort of liquid and atomized workforce. It's also a rather weak one. It doesn't have the kind of muscle that the labor unions and simply geographically localized industrial power once had. So what you have is a liquid labor force that is relatively free but also relatively weak. And in many cases, they will seek to strengthen their weakness by appealing to certain kinds of government support for a minimum wage hikes, for example, or something that this liquid labor force is generally susceptible to seeing the appeal within. Now, looking at these three tiers of the American economy, is there anything here that we see as being terribly hopeful for conservatism? In general, the answer is no. And as I said at the beginning of my remarks, the Republican Party is now increasingly dependent on the remains of what had been the 20th century economic dispensation, what are now considered to be, you know, sort of undereducated, perhaps more industrial and working class oriented voters. Looking forward to what conservatives can do in this situation, they can adopt economic nationalism. They can try to protect and even expand this industrial base that is supportive of the Republican Party and supportive of the conservative side of politics. Alternatively, they can try to invent some sort of new social arrangement, new economic, political, and social interaction. This, of course, is tremendously difficult. You can't simply invent a new economic system overnight. But I will say that this sort of three-tiered economy is something that seems to be very unpropitious to the interests of conservatives and to their philosophical commitments. That with the financial realm and the tech realm seem to be very much inculcated with a politically correct ideology, which has so far proven to be impossible to dislodge from their minds. The administrative slice of the American economy and workforce is basically addicted to government regulation and to preservation of its own kind of protections of power. For example, the health industry and the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry all rely upon their relationships with government, as of course does banking. And then this liquid labor force is so proletarianized and reduced, so atomized and unconnected from economic or social institutions, that it really is not a very fertile ground for the creation of any kind of conservative conservative political base or social base. I think this leads us to, you know, some very daunting conclusions about the future of conservatism in the United States. And you can see why economic nationalism and, in general, nationalism as a whole has taken hold as the new philosophy of the Republican Party and of much of the conservative movement, because it is at least still attached to a localized form of production. It's attached to a sense of American strength in the world and competition with other nations. It does not have a utopian view of a global free market that, in fact, does not exist because of the power of foreign governments and the very self-interested policies they pursue. But economic nationalism may very well not be enough. And whether it's because of the technological changes in our economy that are also wearing away at the industrial base, or whether it's simply because some of these embedded forms of economic transformation and liberalization are now irresistible. And if that's the case, if economic nationalism is not going to be the bulwark and the backstop of conservatism in the 21st century, we're going to need to think of something that is radically new and that is radically different from what we are looking at with this three-tiered economy split between finance and technology on the one hand, the administrative powers on the other, and a liquid labor force as the third element. Thank you.